I don't know. Honestly, I think I'm much more on the avoidant, on the avoidant side of things, but that disorganized one, like that push pull and the back and forth and the hot and cold, it's like, wow, like you can see that in so many places, in so many relationships. It makes perfect sense.
Right.
I wasn't going to say it, but I thought so too. I was like, oh yeah, great. For sure.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast.
On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're speaking with counselor and sexuality educator Ruby Bowie Johnson. We're going to tackle a big topic that has been requested many, many times, which is managing mental health and relationships, and also the question of how one's mental health interacts with non-monogamy. So Ruby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Yeah. So to start out, can we first just ask a little bit about what inspired you to start working in the mental health field and sexuality education too?
I've been a therapist since 2002. So this is year 17. I actually did not plan to get into the mental health field. It happened when I got my master's in social work. The main jobs were in the mental health field. I was actually wanting to do community organizing. Which I'm doing now, actually. Yeah. And so I kind of fell into it and I was told I'm good at it. So that's been what I've been doing the entire time. And since I used to work in psychiatric hospitals and residential treatment facilities, and I encountered people in open relationships often. At that time, I did not know what was going on, but that set the stage for me to start getting into the sexuality field and just about, you know, sexual health and how people can be safe in their sexual practices and how comprehensive sexual health is something that's beyond that. It's about pleasure, consent. And so that happened about 6 years ago.
Wow. That's really interesting that, like, cause I feel like, you know, if you went into that and started working with people with mental health issues, and then from there, just seeing, oh, there's a need for this, and that's what grew into it,
yeah,
rather than like, oh, you know, I had this hobby of being kinky, and over here I had this job, and so I'm just going to mix the two. That's really cool that you really sought out to educate yourself and then educate others in that.
Yes, yes, and that's always something that is very important, is to be a consistent and constant life learner. I believe that if I stop learning, I stop being creative and I stop being able to do what I love to do. So, and I've discovered that kink was a word 6 years ago. I was just doing it since I was 17.
Got it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I discovered kink. Now, this is what this is. Oh, this is what I've been doing. That's actually more than 6 years, like 10 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
That's great.
How long has it been for you that in your practice you've been open about, you know, specializing in working with clients who are non-monogamous or kinky or in that field in some way?
It's been about 5 to 6 years. I've been working mostly exclusive with individuals who are non-monogamous and kinky. I discovered that people actually want to know if you're doing this theoretically or in practice. So I started to be more open with the podcast, like your podcast that I was on a couple of years ago.
Right.
And those particular ways of communicating with people. And so they discovered that I also work with people in my private practice with non-monogamy.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, in my own work with clients, that has been a recurring theme that I've heard, that you know, either people go out and find a therapist or a counselor who doesn't know anything about kink or non-monogamy and they have a really negative experience, or they find someone who lists themselves as poly-friendly or kink-friendly, and the person is like, yeah, it was fine, but this person had never actually been in any of these kink situations or in any of these non-monogamous situations. And so as far as actually being able to relate or, you know, reflect any kind of actual practical knowledge, that was kind of non-existent. And so it does seem, at least That's what I'm saying, that people do really appreciate knowing that at least their therapist or their counselor or someone who's guiding them, I guess it has had some kind of like on the ground, they get it on a certain level, even if they're not no longer non-monogamous or kinky or whatever, that there's some kind of deep knowing that's there. That's not just, not just, I took a weekend workshop as a therapist about polyamory or whatever.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a whole new language. It's a whole new culture, you know, and the culture itself is something that unless you are entrenched within it, unless you are really in it and understand it, it's difficult to give that to another client because they'll spend their time educating you. You know, a client can come to me and say, you know, I was in this triad and then it turned into a V, and, you know, now the V is no longer working and we want to be polyfidelitous. And having those two sentences, they can spend an entire session educating their therapist on what that means.
Right. And there's your copay out the window.
Yeah.
or if you don't take insurance, you know, that's a whole lot of money out the window.
Exactly.
I make sure that my clients actually are getting what they're needing by communicating to them. Okay, you can come in to see me, and you don't have to give me 2 hours of, you know, prep.
Right.
Before I'm able to help.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So I want to dive into the topic at hand. It's a very broad topic. It's definitely impossible to cover in one episode. This will probably be, you know, in the future of our podcast, we'll probably end up doing multiple episodes on the topic of mental health. And because it's so broad, that's why I specifically reached out to our patron community, our private patron group, and I just posed the question, you know, what are your most important questions? What are the things you wonder about? What are the things you worry about when it comes to mental health and relationships? And we got so many responses on that thread, and in reading through all of these responses, there were certainly some recurring themes that emerged. So I'm going to dive into these themes kind of one by one, and I can read you some of the specific questions and comments that we got from our listeners. And it's okay if it's a little organic and we kind of go all over the place, but I thought that that's kind of where we can begin. So one of the themes that came out, and I kind of want to just knock this out right away, is that something that a lot of people have heard, or something that I've even seen get tossed around, even in fairly non-monogamous positive circles, is this sentiment that people who have mental health issues or people who are neurodivergent in some way are inherently going to find non-monogamous relationships more difficult. So I'm going to read you a specific comment from one of our listeners. They say, I feel like I've heard before that attempting non-monogamy is not a great idea if you're suffering from one or more mental illnesses, and that's something that is stuck in my brain while trying to navigate this lifestyle for myself. Could you please speak to that and maybe affirm those of us suffering that are making a go of this?
Oh, absolutely, and that is a huge myth. That's actually a very sad myth. Like with any relationship, I mean, most of us at some level experience anxiety, sadness, et cetera, and that does not say that we are inappropriate or ill-equipped to be within a relationship. I think with anyone who has any mental difference, and that's the word I like to use, are, you know, differences versus, you know, the pathological, you know, disease or illness. I like to use differences. For any one of us who have emotional or mental differences, I think it's important to recognize that we can have healthy, loving relationships. And the same way that we take care of our hygiene, you know, it's the same way that we would take care of our mental well-being, is as long as we're communicating and we have people around us who actually see our worth regardless of, we can have successful relationships. So yes, and now the reason I'm saying we is because I have depression, you know, and I take medication, and so, and I have many relationships. So you know, I'm not only speaking from my years of practice, I'm also speaking personally. That is absolutely possible to have loving relationships, many loving relationships, and your mental well-being does not have to deter that at all.
Right. Yeah, it definitely does kind of beg the question of, at least the image that comes to mind for me is, well, if we kind of start hacking away at like, well, if you have this particular mental difference or mental illness or whatever, then you're not cut out for non-monogamy, that then it starts to become like, well, how perfectly, quote unquote, perfectly mentally healthy do you have to be able to be in a relationship? Because I feel like none of us fit that bill, honestly, at the end of the day.
Right, exactly. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. And the reason that that's important to understand is that it doesn't create that big you, or, you know, that false dichotomy of well, unwell, or, you know, that us, them type of mentality, that separateness. And when we want connection within polyamorous relationships, because that's what we're about, is connection and intimacy. And if we have that barrier in between us based upon something that is not true, how sad is that? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this is totally anecdotal and not scientific at all, but I feel like just from my experience talking with people, I think, like, for example, autism seems to be quite highly represented amongst poly communities that I know, just as an example of how, like, to kind of counter this idea that someone who's mentally, you know, who's mentally different or neurodivergent or whatever term we want to use, like, that they wouldn't be cut out for it. I don't know if you've experienced that at all, but I just feel like anecdotally I've noticed that.
Yeah, you know, cognitive differences as well, you know, persons who are on the autism spectrum. You know, I do find in practice that there are individuals, I don't want to say overrepresentative, but I do encounter many people whom are autistic who want to have relationships, you know, and looking at the various, what I work with those clients typically is around identifying those particular cues socially, verbally, that something is going on and something is happening within a relationship, because there's a lot of concrete thinking. But that does not say, hey, you cannot have a relationship. That is a misnomer also.
So now I want to pivot a little bit to another topic that came up quite a bit. And this is about, and this is a big one, I think, particularly because often people have multiple partners, and it's how to care for a partner's mental health. And so a couple examples of this is, one is the question, how do I make sure my partner with depression / mental health issue is okay while at the same time maintaining my own mental well-being? And another one, like, how do I avoid burnout after caring for a partner or multiple partners who are in crisis because of that?
That is a fantastic question. I love that. And that's what I spend a lot of time doing, is teaching people how to be supportive. And one of the things that I tend to emphasize is that there's no fixing here. Recognizing between you and your partner what your role is as a support person, and having a shared meaning of what supportive means, and asking that partner, you know, how can I best support you? Those are some important questions, because when we take it on ourselves and become someone's, you know, nurse or doctor, that's where that emotional labor becomes very overwhelming, and it can definitely lead to burnout, and it can push you away from an individual. And I think it's important that your partner make sure they have a therapist of their own, and not make you their therapist, you know, and make sure that your partner is taking ownership for their well-being. And it's like with anything, you know, with diet, with, you know, with hypertension, with diabetes, it's a personal thing to take care of. And when you go to support, you know, support is being that extra set of eyes and ears, because sometimes you may not even be able to see when you're in an episode or something is going on and happening. But also for the support person to have their own support. I recommend that there's like family members that they can go to support groups or et cetera. And I believe in treating the entire system, you know, the entire polycule, coming up with, you know, ways to communicate with communication boards or ways to communicate it via text. You know, we have Google Calendar for everything. Mm-hmm. Why not have a mental well-being calendar? You know, if I'm feeling this way, you know, send me a text and a cue that this is a day not to bother me, or some level of communication. And I think the responsibility falls on both people.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I'm trying to think through, like, when these discussions come up, what are some of the responses to that? And I feel like one that comes up a lot is sort of this response of, but my partner can't take care of themselves.
Well, that's either that's your perception, that person's perception that the partner can't take care of themselves, or is that's part of the stigma. And that stigma that's attached with people who have mental or cognitive differences is that they are incapable of taking care of themselves. And they put them in this helpless position, when actually there's a lot of strength and resilience that is a muscle with people who have mental differences, because they've had to manage it for a lot of years. Wow. And so for the support to trust that they can take care of themselves is something that will also free them up from so much emotional labor, because It could be they're putting it on themselves.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I feel like very empowering for the person with the cognitive differences too, to know that, oh, my partner also trusts me to take care of myself.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
And to make sure that person tells them, I'm with you because I love you, and I don't need, if I wanted a, you know, a nurse, or if I wanted somebody to help me, I would hire them. But you're my, you know, you're my lover, you're my friend, you're my whatever, and that's the role I have you in my life, not that.
Right.
And so that's important also.
Yeah, I really want to highlight, and I appreciate you putting the emphasis on, if you're in a support role, also making sure that you're getting your own support as well. I think that something that I see happen so often is, and again, this is even in a monogamous relationship or non-monogamous or whatever, but whenever you have the dyad, like the two people, that there can be the person who's going through a crisis or going through a challenge, leaning on their partner for support. And then the person who's supporting gets so burnt out and exhausted that then they come right back to that partner in crisis being like, I need you to listen and support me and how difficult it is to support you right now. And it can become kind of like, I see it becoming like passing the suffering back and forth to each other,
right.
You know, and just kind of exhausting the collective resources, even in the dyad, you know, which I think is something that seems as important to avoid.
Right. And I agree with you. I agree with you with that. And the beauty around being in polyamorous relationships or non-monogamous relationships is that you can have, not necessarily all the time, but you can have those other people who are in caring positions, you know, not necessarily supportive, but caring positions that you can talk to and say, okay, this is my struggle. This is what's going on. I feel powerless. I feel this, I feel overwhelmed, I don't feel they're doing what they need to do, and have someone on the outside to talk to that's not necessarily so up close and personal where they can't see that there's a possible solution here. And that's what it's important. Sometimes you just want to vent. Sometimes you just want to let it out, and it's okay to want to vent. It's better to get it out than hold it in, and then that resentment comes, and then you really don't want to be around that person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's so healthy. It's so healthy to have your own support system for your own mental well-being, you know, because you can get physiologically exhausted, and that impacts how you emotionally respond. You become more volatile, more irritable, and then that triggers the person who has
the mental differences, and because there's already probably some issues going on with self-esteem. You see how that viciousness...
Yeah, mm-hmm. It cycles back around like that. Yeah.
That energy goes through, you know, and that's with any good systems theory. Any therapist understands, you know, how those systems and those feedback loops can impact it. And, you know, you can come in and disrupt it. That's important. How are you disrupting that feedback loop so everybody can see what's going on? And that's a big part of my job in the office, is to disrupt.
Yeah, 100%.
And I'm talking a whole lot.
No, it's okay. I want to also ask about, you talked about, you know, how you believe in treating the whole system or the whole polycule, and again, kind of creating the systems that allow for that feedback loop to not be happening. Do you have examples of stuff that you've seen of, you know, kind of effective strategies that entire polycules have been able to take on to kind of be able to avoid that daisy chain or that like really negative domino effect?
Well, one of the things that tends to happen when you break it down and you do a lovely genogram on the board, I have a whiteboard and I love my whiteboard, which is I break it down with all of the members of the polycule and I see how they're spinning. And that's usually what I point out is a good strategy, is to see how everyone is spinning around the person who is not doing well at any given moment. And that when the system is spinning around that one person, everyone kind of loses themselves. So it's kind of like that person is in the middle and everyone is going around taking care of that person. So removing that person out of the middle of it and letting them be their own entity and you not necessarily spin around them is a huge piece of the disruption. Because if they become the focus, then what about all of the rest of your relationships and what you're doing in your life if that person is the center of everything? Now, it does come to time when a system has to, or family members, when it's getting into a place that is very precarious where you may need to rally around someone and help them. But that's any someone. Any someone could need a rally, you know, around. And it's recognizing how you can get caught up in within the illness itself or within what's going on itself. You can get caught up. And then when everyone is caught up in it, you can't really help. All of this is making sense. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine that involves a lot of needing to empower the other people in the polycule to have good boundaries and a good sense of like their own capacity and expectations. At least that's what I would guess.
Boundaries is a fantastic word. I love that. Yeah. And that's definitely it, because it's real easy to become enmeshed in polyamory to where you don't know where you end and someone else begins, because it is set up around so much communication and so much intimacy that it can sometimes get to a point when it's not balanced, it becomes very detrimental. And so a good one, Bowenian theory that talks about differentiation of self, which is a therapeutic approach. When you start to say, okay, I'm a member of this polycule or I'm a member of this relationship, but I'm also my own individual with my own boundaries, with my own identity. You know, I'm more than my partner's lover, or I'm more than their support, or I'm more than their caregiver. I'm actually my own person. And that's another way to stay healthy. If each person is able to recognize their individual selves and take care of those, and eventually, in addition to being supportive, that also helps with the polycule staying healthy. You know, there's a larger ecosystem of the polycule, and then there's your little individual ecosystem of self. And when both of those are balanced, that's when things are maintained very healthy.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So kind of segueing from that a little bit into the next topic that came up quite a bit is this question of, I guess it has to do with boundaries, like you were talking about, but kind of trying to evaluate when it's too much. So some examples here is what to do, for example, when your partner or a metamour potentially is not acknowledging or addressing their own mental health or their own mental differences. And another example is when you find yourself in a situation where you feel like you need to make the decision to, quote, abandon them to preserve your own mental health, and how, you know, some people shared about how they struggle with that debate. Others saying, I had to make that choice years ago. I still feel bad about it, but it was the right choice for me. It's, it's such a, gosh, it's so, such an emotionally charged topic. You know, that's such a hard thing. But I was wondering what your experience has been working with people in those sorts of questions.
Oh, wow. So big.
Yeah.
I'm trying to put my thoughts together on it because I've seen it with personality disorders. I've seen it with people who have untreated bipolar disorder, or some people who have, you know, untreated depression, anxiety, individuals who have substance abuse.
Yeah.
And so that is such a huge one. And when one gets into the position of their, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? They're wanting that person to stay well more than that person wants to stay well. That's a huge red flag. When you're scheduling the doctor's appointments, or you're going to pull them out of the bar, or, you know, that individual has an episode to where they're very erratic and they're, you know, volatile, and it becomes abusive, and all of these things that are huge red light indicators that there is an unmanageable state that is constant within a relationship. You have to recognize within yourself when you have reached your limitations. Not to say that you're abandoning that person, but that person has abandoned themselves, and you can't be their life preserver. You know, they have to actually put it on themselves and pull themselves up. And it can be I can't be with you right now because you're not taking care of yourself, and it's starting to make me not well. I'm feeling exhausted, and this has been going on for 2 months, and I don't know what to do other than to give myself space so that I can recover. Because this is a system. This is a family thing. And when someone is not taking care of themselves, it impacts the entire family. So imagine other relationships that are being hit because I'm so focused on keeping you alive that I'm dying over here, you know? And those are hard conversations to have, but sometimes they need to happen.
It kind of, it makes me think.
Everybody has a bottom. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was making me think about what you were saying earlier about, you know, trusting your partner to take care of themselves, and that your job isn't to fix them, but to be there to support them while they're dealing with, you know, while they're dealing with themselves. That it almost seems like it's kind of an extension of that. It's like also not being like, it's, you can't, Not only like, do you not need to fix them? Because I think sometimes people feel guilty, like, oh, but I should, but like that you can't actually, that's just not a thing you can do from the outside.
Yes. Mm. Right. Absolutely. You can't, you know, you can't force feed people recovery or well-being. Either they're going to swallow it whole and digest it, or they can choke by not wanting to deal with it. And that's one of the things that I use a metaphor of choking and digesting. And sometimes people can get caught in their own, you know, their own stigma around being flawed, and shame is real big and can eat your lunch when if you have mental you know, mental differences or cognitive differences or emotional or substance abuse or personality. All of these things can eat you up if you're so over-identifying with being flawed or having shame.
Yeah.
I want to do an entire episode on shame. I've been doing a workshop myself on, you know, on like healing shame for, you know, counselors and coaches and therapists and stuff like that. And it's just like so huge and so all encompassing. And I feel like specifically in American culture, we're so indoctrinated to like carry shame, but pretend that we're not ashamed. I think just so many people are caught up in that push pull just all the time. And it just spills over into so many different arenas of life.
Yeah. I'm going to a training the next 3 days with Brené Brown, and it's the Dare to Lead training. And a huge piece of her work is about how shame impacts vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things is individuals do not want to get vulnerable and even say, I'm scared that this is going on. I can't control it. I don't know what to do about it. And just stating certain things like that is what builds that shame resilience. Mm-hmm. And sitting down in front of, you know, a polycule or a quad or, you know, just people who are in a dyad, sitting down in front of them and saying, when's the last time you told your partner that you're scared? Scared of them leaving you, scared of not being who you think you should be within this relationship. When's the last time you said that? And that's another thing, is that people don't want to admit those things. You know, even a support, I'm scared that I won't be able to do this or you're going to do this. You know, it comes from everybody just naming it. That's a huge one. Just name what's going on.
Yeah. And I feel like I've seen this added level. I think as there's more people who are, I guess, more quote unquote savvy to non-monogamy culture and polyamory culture and stuff like that, or people who've been doing it a long time, that there can be then this added layer of, well, I shouldn't be scared because I've read all the books and listened to all the podcasts and logic my way out of, you know, how love is so abundant. It doesn't change the way I love my partner or how they love me, and then it's okay. And I know I've definitely felt that personally in the past, that it's like, I shouldn't feel scared. You know, this fear should, or this vulnerability shouldn't come up because I should know better. And I think I'm starting to see a little bit more of that, this kind of added layer to delving into those more vulnerable, sticky feelings.
Right. Right. Isn't that amazing how people who are monogamous don't have those same internal dialogues? I've been non-monogamous since I was an infant. I shouldn't be. No. Mm-hmm. You know, that's that holy grail mentality, that there's one way to do this, one way to do that.
Yeah. If I just figure out the right way, it'll never be hard again.
Right. Right. And then it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to dive into what I would argue was maybe on the thread that I posted, the topic that came up the most compared to the rest of these. And so I'm just going to read a couple examples. So someone asked, how do I differentiate when my behavior stems from symptoms of my own mental illness or past trauma that aggravates those illnesses? Or when is it me being a crappier controlling person who needs to step back? And I have another related question. How do I tell the difference between unmanaged mental illness and just bad behavior? I don't want to stigmatize mental illness, and I also need to figure out my own boundaries around others' behaviors that affect me negatively. But sometimes it's hard to tell which end is up. And we got a lot of comments related to that, of people wondering both about their own behavior and a partner's behavior, maybe a metamorph's behavior, of how much of this can I chalk up to mental difference or mental health issues? How much of this can I chalk up to someone just kind of being crappy or behaving poorly?
Oh, wow. That's a nice dichotomy right there. you know, and the thing is that comes with time. You know, just like we build trust incrementally along a relationship, we begin to see people's true selves the same way. And so having an understanding of what you're dealing with is really important. Do your own independent research, do your own reading, go to support groups, talk to people. That's when you become that learner. And once you become that learner, you're better able to see things because you have information. When people, you can have quote unquote bad behavior, and you can also have a mental difference diagnosis or something of that effect, that doesn't mean that one is feeding the other one. Hmm. And so that's something also important to recognize, that everything is tied to that. Now, they did mention trauma, and I'm going to put a pin in that one and come back to it.
Yeah.
Because trauma responses are very interesting. And so having an understanding of the individual, talking to the individual and asking, so I've noticed this, is this something that's a part of blank, or is this something else? I just want to call it and I want to name it, because I can sit here and come up with my own assumptions and I don't want to assume. Mm. And then when they say, oh, this is this, and it's because of this, and then, okay, so they have identified the problem. Now they have to come up with their solution to it. And after a while, if you keep pointing it out and you keep seeing the same thing, you may want to take stock and, maybe this is something more than their mental well-being. Maybe this is something different. And that's kind of like that wait and see, or that investigation that we do within relationships with anything. And so that's my best solution to that. And then you have the trauma responses. And typically those activating events, I use the word activating because triggered is so watered down. It's so overused and so misused, but there's things that activate us, you know, and with those activating events, there's certain responses, you know, fight, flight, freeze that can happen, which can be very bizarre behavior. For example, I like to use this analogy. You know, there's been a lot of shootings. I work a lot with Black queer people, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of shootings, you know, with cops and on Black bodies. And so one of the things that I like to point out is that when you're in an activating situation like that and they say, get down on the ground, you're frozen. Mm-hmm. You don't know how to move or how to maneuver with that. And people don't recognize that sometimes things are trauma response, because there's this consistent attack on someone, you know, just being Black, and then you're asking them to get down on the ground. They don't want to make a sudden move because you don't want to get shot, but yet you get shot anyway. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. This is something that, it's going to sound weird to say, but it's near and dear to my heart, because for myself, like I left a physically abusive relationship a few years ago, and then for the first time in my life started experiencing like PTSD symptoms, and I never had in my entire life. And it was my first time ever having to figure out how to deal with this or learn about this. And I really went down this big rabbit hole of learning about trauma responses and doing training and stuff like that. And it really is just this, I say the word amazing, not necessarily with a positive bent, but just almost like awe-inspiring, kind of what the body can do with a very, very little activation, essentially, or like an event that would not seem activating to anybody else in the world, but to you, it gets you into that frozen up, locked up trauma response.
Right.
And that's another one where I want to do a whole other episode talking about PTSD and trauma, because that's definitely something that I think more of us need to be talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, that also goes into attachment, you know, and we talk about it within relationships. Attachment, it's, you know, there's disorganized attachment, there's anxious, there's avoidant, you know, there's that rescue attachment, all of these different types of attachment that comes from being insecure within your relationships or insecure within self or the environment. And that can also bring about behavior. I think attachment is something that is amazing to use within non-monogamous or polyamorous relationships, because how we attach to people dictates a whole lot about our anxiety, our depression, our moods, and all of that, the insecurity that we have and the lack of confidence within our relationships. It's also something to explore with mental well-being.
Yeah, so I was only familiar with like avoidant attachment, like fearful avoidant attachment, anxious attachment, secure attachment. You mentioned a couple others I wasn't familiar with. You mentioned the disorganized and I think one other.
Rescue attachment.
And rescue.
Rescue. Yeah. Can you give just kind of a brief like Cliff Notes version of those two?
Yeah, disorganized is when you have both the avoidant and the anxious and they're kind of operating in the same space. It's kind of like, get away from me, but come towards me. Get away from me and come towards me. Or you have that friend foe, you know, that friend, you know, either you're my enemy or I want to be around you, but I can't stand being around you. And it kind of creates that wibble wobble that people say, you know, they're giving me mixed messages. I don't know what to do. Mm. You know, that type of space that you're operating within is because you don't know what to do. The person who's in that particular attachment, they're scared, they are overwhelmed, but they love you and they want to be with you. And then you have that rescue attachment. That's the person who wants to go in and fix, you know, and they kind of get their sense of worth by fixing and taking care of, or, you know, becoming indispensable in some type of way. And so that's that one.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah, I can think of like a billion examples just hearing about that. But
yeah, no, that's the one in my personal life that I've had to work very hard to stop doing, the fixing.
Rescuing?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
See, because I very relate to the disorganized one. I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I think I'm much more on the avoidant. On the avoidant side of things, but that disorganized one, like that push pull and the back and forth and the hot and cold, it's like, wow, like you can see that in so many places, in so many relationships. Yeah. It makes perfect sense.
Right.
I wasn't going to say it, but I thought so too. I was for sure.
Okay, good. I guess it's good. I said it first then.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. I want to move us to another topic here. I feel like this is one that we could just keep talking about for another 2 hours and do a whole other, you know, mini series on it or something. But this next one is about basically ways to disclose mental health status or mental health differences or something. So again, I'm going to give you some examples of the way this question showed up. How do I disclose my own mental health status or trauma history to a potential partner? When should I disclose that? And then relatedly, but sort of from the other side, is it okay to disclose my partner's mental health status to other partners? And then another one is what one should look for or ask to vet whether a potential partner or partner's mental illness is going to be a red flag or kind of a disqualifier for an intimate relationship. You know, that kind of covered a broad range there, but maybe we can tackle the first two first and then move on to that one.
Yes. Yes. Disclosure.
Yeah.
For a long time now, we've been fans of adamandeve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love adamandeve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
So disclosure, number one, I wouldn't disclose another partner's. I let that partner disclose for themselves. I just want to toss that out there first. Mm-hmm. I gave this example. I did a panel at Black Poly Pride, and we did a role play. And within the role play, I played the person who was going to disclose. And I had been seeing this person for like 6 weeks. And we decided, okay, our vetting period, our consideration period, you know, using that kink terminology, was around 6 weeks to, you know, 2 months out. And you see that it's probably going to go somewhere. And you decided to disclose to the individual and speak in I statements, right? Disclosing can be as big or as little as you want it to be. Would I lead in with it going into a new relationship? Personally, I probably would not, but that's up to you. Mm-hmm. But going into it when it's appropriate, timing, because sometimes we can overshare things about ourselves, and it's kind of like it can be off-putting. Not that you have to keep it a secret, but there's parts of you, you got to make sure people can handle, you know, and they build their trust that they can handle yourself and all you are and giving that to them. And so the example that I gave within the workshop is that, you know, we've been seeing each other for a little while, and there's some things that I want to share about me because I want you to be informed. I want you to have informed consent about what you're, you know, who you're going to get within this relationship. I have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I have a psychiatrist. I take my medication, and I have a therapist. I just want you to know that I'm taking care of myself. But I think it's important that you know that these aspects of me, and I trust that you can honor and respect that I'm taking care of myself. Those type of conversations. And I think it's important that when you're disclosing, to let the person across from you know that you're taking care of your business and what you need to do. Does that answer your question?
No, I think that's great, adding the piece, because I think that especially if it gets shared really early on, that I have found that there can be this reaction of sort of panic of like, oh gosh, like, does that mean I'm going to have to take care of you? Does that mean I'm going to have to like learn to be your therapist or those things? Because I think we are sort of taught that assumption that, you know, we end up sort of being the everything to our partner, including their therapist and their doctor and their personal trainer and, you know, whatever else. You so know, I like and, that, and including that piece. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with polyamory, we're like, everyone can't be my everything, right?
Right.
So we kind of had that ingrained within us, you know, not, you can't be my everything. And that's absolutely correct. I don't want you to be my therapist or my psychiatrist. As a therapist, I have to say that all the time. I'm not your therapist. You don't pay me.
Right.
I make this amount of money an hour.
Yeah.
And I don't do dual relationships. I'm right. not your therapist and I'm not your lover.
It's one or the other, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you also, real quick, I wanted to clarify something. You talked about the like vetting period, or you had another term for it that's from the kink world. And for our listeners who are not part of the kink scene or who are new to it, could you explain real quick what that means?
Oh, being under consideration.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a top. And so that means that I'm a dom. I'm a fem dom.
Mm-hmm.
And so when someone wants to be a submissive, I call it being under consideration, which is the interview stage to where we figure out if our values, our wants, what we're needing, what our expectations are, protocol, all of that is part of the discussion, you know. And for me, the under consideration or the vetting stage, which is, you can use that interchangeably, is a long process, like 6 months to 9 months. But during that time, this is when all that information will come forth. And, you know, in the kink world, dealing with that, dealing with mental differences and cognitive differences really plays into negotiation. And so that's a whole other episode.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So could we go to the second, or like that last question that was part of that, which was, what should one look for or ask to vet whether a potential partner, Yeah, whether a partner's mental illness or a potential partner's mental illness is a disqualifier or red flag or something for having an intimate relationship with them. And that's when you were like, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, yeah. If they say that they don't believe in medication, you know, not that everybody has to be on medication, but, you know, there's that's a strong statement of that. You know, having a mental differences, you know, it's about neurochemistry, you know, and about how we fire in the brain somewhat. And so having a medication as part of it can sometimes be very necessary. Sometimes being on vitamins, you know, B12, vitamin D, folic, that can definitely deal with it and you can manage it that way. But having, if there is no level of intervention, that's a huge red flag. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be some level of intervention going on or present, you know, from people have seasonal affective disorder. You know, right now I'm asking clients, so are you going to a tanning bed? Are you, you know, what are you doing to take care of yourself? Because wintertime is a struggle for many, many clients because of just what's going on within the environment period, you know? And so this is a busy time in my office. But those are some of the questions like, if you want to ask, you know, well, how many of your relationships ended because of something, or, you know, are you in other relationships right now? And how they talk about those relationships, just the questions that give you an idea of how things are being managed for them and how their perspective and how they see what's going on with them are some questions.
Right.
And those are really valid questions to ask. Very valid.
I feel like those are great questions to ask, even if you were dating monogamously, of just like, you know, asking someone about how did your previous relationships end? You know, it's like asking a job candidate, why are you not at your previous job anymore?
Jeez.
Well, and I mean, that's, you know, seriously though, that it's like, if they go like, oh, well, she was crazy. And you know, that it's like, okay, maybe that's a red flag that you're actually the issue here.
Yeah, so it seems like it boils down to just seeing if this person has an awareness of like how they need to care for themselves and how they need to manage what's going on, and that channel around that is open.
Yeah, that's just a couple of questions that you can ask if you want to, and that's stuff that, and please allow it to happen organically.
Okay, you know? So don't sit down at the interview table.
No, let it happen organically over a course of conversation. If I can say anything about any of this, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, an interrogation, like you said, rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
Things can just ease into conversations very naturally. And if someone wants to disclose something to you, they'll disclose it naturally. You know, eventually things will come out, but just, I encourage people just to let it happen organically.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I feel like
Is that fair?
It does. It reminds me of the meme that I've seen floating around a couple of different places where it's just like, hey, can you tell me like all your traumas and baggage right now before we get into a relationship and you start projecting that shit onto me, basically. Yeah. Yeah. So here's another recurring one that came up, and is basically a lot of people are asking about, what if you have two people in a relationship who both have some mental differences, maybe both are neurodivergent, maybe both have certain mental illness or both have trauma or something like that. And the way that a lot of people phrased it is like, what if these things are incompatible? And so here's some examples some people gave. So for example, you have one partner with a need for transparency due to anxiety and another partner with a need for total privacy due to trauma or something like that. Another example someone gave was, you know, one person needs to have super clear plans in order to feel safe, and another person can't make super clear plans because of issues with executive functioning or things like that. Have you come across situations like that also?
All the time. All the time. And it is intention. And that's all I can say. When there's something like that, where there's typically when someone is in need of holding back, it's around fear. When someone is in need of, you know, anxious and needing to know, that's around fear. And it's around confidence. And that's that attachment stuff that we talked about. And trauma responses, you know, and I'm the person who wants to be private. It's like someone has hurt them along the way to where that privacy was trampled on, or
was used against them.
It was used as a weapon, or some level of gaslighting or something like that that's going on. One of the things is to allow that safe container to be built is one. It's going to take, I'm trying to make this real simple. It's going to take each person, because I can go into a litany of things that can happen, but it's going to take each person being intentional and understanding what each person needs, yet not cutting themselves off at the needs with themselves not getting what they need from that other person. It's going to be a level of reciprocity that has to happen. And incompatibility, incompatible means that it's not something that can be pushed through. I mean, it's just not going to mesh, and it may not work. It's kind of putting a nail in the coffin. I can't think of anything better to say right now. But I believe that there's certain things that are incompatible. But someone who has a trauma response and someone who has anxiety, I think that's something that can be worked through, and time will tell on that one. But both people have to be patient and be able to give a little give and take in those particular situations. And so that's a real difficult one to answer straightforward. A plus B equals C.
Yeah.
Right. That seems very context dependent and dependent on the people involved, because it makes sense. Again, in this scenario, if it's the one person who needs transparency because of their anxiety and the other person who needs privacy because of their trauma, that it sounds like you're saying that if both of us can figure out the give and take, figure out what are the areas where we can push through this and kind of push the edge, work through the, you know, work outside the comfort zone to find a new normal that works for both people, then that's good. But if it's a situation where it's more of a black and white of a, like, no, I just can't compromise on needing total transparency, or no, I just can't compromise on needing complete privacy, that then maybe that's just straight up incompatible at the end of the day.
That's why you're the writer and you can put things in
words. Oh, gosh.
you said that very well. Can I steal that?
Yeah, if you like. Shucks. Yeah, okay. This also brings up for me personally, I don't know if this counts as a mental difference thing or not. Maybe this is something we should have covered in the scheduling episode, Jace, that we just recorded a little while ago, but something I have bumped up against in my life. I see a lot of people talk about this, but around the planning incompatibility, that there is one person where it's like, the way I organize my life is around Google Calendar. I need to have things planned out. I need to know what's going on in a relationship with the person who's like, I don't know what's going on until an hour before I do it, you know? And I could see that some of that could come down to mental difference stuff, you know, like this person mentioned in their example, someone who has an issue with executive functioning and maybe can't make plans ahead of time. But it seems like it also comes down to preference as well. Have you dealt with people who kind of have those same like differences around like planning and scheduling?
Yes. And people like to call it type A, type B. I like to call it being, you know, ambiguous and committed and, and the reason that I say it that way is that some people like to have that, you know, there's many things. Some people feel pressure by schedules. They feel like they can't uphold a schedule. Some people have issues around fear of missing out. You know, they don't want something better to come along. You know, that FOMO stuff will eat you up all the time.
Mm. Yeah.
And so those are some of the things that can happen. And I don't know if it's any particular cognitive difference other than, I mean, this sounds also partly like personality.
Yeah.
Issues. Because I'm trying to think cognitively, what would that fall under that couldn't necessarily be like a mental well-being thing? And so right. I'm trying to think. I mean, all I can think of is if someone is in a depressive episode or a manic episode, you know, with bipolar or depression, you know, they're sad, they can't really come forth and make a commitment to anything, either because it's the racing and, you know, that sense of euphoria, and they're not able to pin them down, or someone who's so depressed, they're not able to make a commitment because they're just trying to make it day by day. Those right. are the things that pop up into my mind. And I don't know if that's the question that people were, question that you had about yourself personally.
But I think that makes sense. That totally makes sense how that would apply here for sure.
Yeah. So as we said, we could talk about this stuff just on and on for many episodes, but we have reached the end for today. However, Ruby, I know it just flew by, right? So Ruby, you do so many things and you organize so many things. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you have going on and where they can find more of you, more of your work, all the things that you do?
You can find my work at blacksexgeek.net. I organize a conference called Polyballast Millennium. We're on our fifth year, and it's a conference that focuses on individual and non-monogamous relationships, rather experienced, questioning, or curious. And we center folks that are non-binary, trans, or folks of color. But we do not exclude anyone. We like to laugh, have a good time. This upcoming one is July 10th through the 12th. We're going to have one of our speakers is Tristan Taramino. We have Ida Mandalay, who's going to be speaking. We have, I always say this wrong, Kimchi Cuddles, Tixel Wolf, who's going to be
Cuddles.
Speaking.
Kimchi Cuddles, yes. Right.
Yeah, Kimchi, thank you. I always say that wrong. Please forgive me. I always say that wrong. And so she's going to be speaking. So we have several speakers that are pretty awesome in the community that are coming out. We also have Marla Stewart, and she's with Sex Down South. So all that. Mm. And also upcoming, I'm collecting manuscripts. I'm the special editor of a journal of Black sexuality and relationships. And there's a special edition on polyamory, the first that's ever been done.
Wow.
And so if you want to submit a manuscript, it's an academic journal, please, I'm accepting them, all you academic people out there on polyamory and race. And I have a chapter of a book that just came out, and I do relationship coaching online, and that's me.
So you're a writer too. You can't call me the writer.
Yes. I love to write.
Wonderful. Yeah, so many things. My goodness. And we'll be including links to all of those things in the write-ups and in our social media posts so that people can find them easily.
And they can find that all through your site, right?
Yes, you can find it all through my website.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
All right, so Ruby is going to stick around for a little bit with us to do a bonus episode for our patrons. And in that, we are going to get Ruby's thoughts about how to evaluate whether a therapist or a counselor is right for you, which is another question that comes up a lot in discussions. So if you're a patron, stick around for that in a couple days. And if you're not, check it out at patreon.com/multiamory. We also want to hear your thoughts. What have your experiences been? Have you wrestled with any of these sorts of questions yourself? Have you found your experience to be different than what we talked about today? The best place that you can share your thoughts with other listeners is on this episode's discussion thread in our private Facebook group or Discord chat. You can get access to these groups and join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can email us at info@multiamory.com. Leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05. or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. Multi-Amory is created and produced by Dedeker Winston, Emily Matlack, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our production assistants are Rachel Schenowork and Carson Collins. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.